Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett, the nation's biggest newspaper company. I'm John Kennedy, coming to you from Gannett's Florida Capitol Bureau in Tallahassee. And I'm joined this week by Antonio Finns, the political editor of the Palm Beach Post, and Mark Harper, politics writer for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Our usual host, Zach Anderson, with the Sarasota Herald Tribune, well, he's on assignment. But today we'll be talking about a Volusia County diner owner who says Joe Biden's voters are no longer welcome. Then you have Governor Ron DeSantis acting shocked that people are talking about him running for president, and the latest twists and turns in the state's COVID-19 policies. But first, you know what that music means. It's pick a number time. And Antonio, surely you've got a number for us.
I do, John, a 2,456.
Good one and intriguing. And Mark?
Well, I'm tempted to say 15, which is the Chicago White Sox magic number. I guess I will stick to Florida politics and go with 40.4 million.
40.4 million. The White Sox don't often have magic numbers, so I know you enjoy them when they're there. But and I have a number this week, too, and it's 48. We'll let you ponder those for a while and be back later in the show to explain how they figure into Florida politics this week. You know, in Florida, when you think about it, ordering a grilled cheese sandwich or a side of fries usually doesn't involve you whipping out your voter registration card or explaining how you voted in the last election. But Mark, you've written about the owner of a diner in DeBary in your home Volusia County who put up a sign notifying Biden voters that they're not welcome in her restaurant. All this coming after the airport attack in Afghanistan that killed U.S. Service members and almost 200 Afghan civilians. Now, you know, we've seen a lot from Ron DeSantis opposing businesses that demand to see proof of vaccination from customers, but businesses banning people for who they support, that one's kind of different. Mark, tell us about the reaction to this, and is this where we're headed now in politics, where we have everybody in their own political bubble, even when it comes to getting a grilled cheese sandwich?
Yeah, John, this is the world in which we live in 2021. Really, it's not a completely new phenomenon in the United States, because when Donald Trump ran for president and won in 2016, there were a number of restaurants that banned Trump and his supporters, as some of the DeBary Diner patrons were very eager to point out to me when I was over there last week. You know, it was a first, as far as I know, in Volusia County, and it was kind of a tables turned situation where it just got a lot of attention in the conservative media. You know, Volusia County is still, you know, Trump DeSantis country. You know, there was a lot of cheering for the DeBary Diner owner. And she posted the note really telling Biden backers to take a hike, by the way, after being outraged over the handling of the Afghanistan pullout. And it was a gesture that was just, you know, popular. People were driving from all around as far as an hour away to eat there. The particular day I was there, the restaurant was closed because it had run out of food the night before. And so, you know, people that were showing up and disappointed they couldn't eat were, you know, attempting to give her tips or sort of pay it forward meals for veterans.
Wow, that's amazing. So it actually turned out to be good for business, I guess.
I bet it will be.
Now, was there any reaction from Biden people who are being refused at the door, I guess?
Well, I got to say, my dad is a Biden supporter, and he also is a DeBary Diner patron. So he was pretty disappointed, but there weren't really any like people protesting or anything like that that I saw.
Wow. Your dad has to take his coffee regular somewhere else, I guess, right now. Antonio, you know, we've been seeing Charlie Crist now, too, a Democrat challenging DeSantis for governor next year. He's taking part in Get Out the Vaccine events in South Florida, a little bit of a twist on the Get Out the Vote, you know, efforts. Now, this isn't as outrageous as a DeBary Diner banning Biden voters, but Crist is finding his own way to sort of exploit the political divide over COVID, it would seem. And, you know, can we expect to see these kind of tactics continue and get sharper as we get closer to the governor's race? And are undecided, persuadable voters going to be hard to find this next election cycle?
I don't know. I'm just feeling bad for Mark's dad. I mean, all you want is a cup of coffee.
Your Biden bucks are no good here.
No, I mean, talk about all politics being local. I mean, this is like hyper local. But look, yeah, to answer your questions, yeah, especially, you know, since this has been the ongoing verbal war between Florida's congressional Democrats, including Crist and the governor, you know, they have sparred every critical juncture of this pandemic, from the business shutdown in April last year, all the way to the debacle in the unemployment claim system, to the eventual reopening of the economy, and then now to wearing of a mask in schools, and, you know, now this vaccination push. Look, the question at the end of the day is the one that Zach pointed out at the end of last week's podcast. Will the heartbreak that Florida has suffered in this pandemic, will it cost DeSantis? Or has the electorate decided, look, that the 3 million infections and nearly 50,000 dead is collateral damage to keep the economy open and, as DeSantis says, keep Florida free? Clearly, those will be the lines in the sand. You know, Crist and Nikki Fried will say the governor left Florida unnecessarily vulnerable. And DeSantis will argue that his Democratic rivals want to, you know, lock down the state like a Soviet Iron Curtain hostage country. Just remember, as you've pointed out yourself, John, DeSantis has more than $50 million to press his case. His rivals have combined less than $4 million, so definitely the advantage of DeSantis here. To answer the other question, yeah, there are people on the fence that can be persuaded. Not a lot of them, but we've seen this in the past. Look, first of all, there's that swing electorate in 2020, for example. It was the Cuban-American vote in Miami-Dade that swung far to former President Trump, eroding the margin that President Biden needed in that county and ultimately giving Trump a very unexpectedly easy win in Florida. I would also point out that at the start of the pandemic, the governor was at, 65% approval? That fell to 43% about a year ago. Then it rose to the low 50s this spring, as it seemed the pandemic had ebbed in Florida, and now has dropped again with the Delta variant crisis. Look, that means there is a segment of the electorate that is still kind of unsure about the governor's handling of the crisis, which looks to remain a campaign issue into 2022. These potential swing voters are a small slice of the electorate, and the wild card here are the many, many thousands of blue state residents that have moved to Florida during the pandemic. You have to think that those new Florida men and Florida women will swell DeSantis' vote total next year. But remember that DeSantis also just won by 33,000 votes in 2018. And before him, Rick Scott won his two governor's races by roughly 60,000 votes each time. The last gubernatorial candidate to win by a landslide, well, that was Republican Charlie Crist. He won in 2006 by almost 400,000 votes. Of course, Democrat Charlie Crist lost one of those Rick Scott close call races in 2014. So history isn't much help here. Then again, a once in a century pandemic upends every other comparison too.
Yeah, that's a good point, Antonio. Yeah, it's remarkable that Charlie Crist is the last landslide governor, and now he's available as a Democrat. You know, Biden losing favor in a Volusia County diner, well, that's one thing, but polls do show that the Democratic president is in a rough spot right now with getting lousy marks from voters on Afghanistan, and frustration continuing to mount over the latest COVID-19 surge. And what we're seeing nationally right now, that seems to be bringing back to life Donald Trump, with one of his former senior aides saying that he's between 99 and 100% likely to run again in 2024. So, you know, what does that mean, say, for a guy like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's been traveling the country raising money and also making appearances at events that seem to be pretty much designed to boost his already substantial national profile? But this week, DeSantis said something a little bit out of the box. He at an unrelated COVID-19 event, he said, all the speculation about me is purely manufactured. And he called talk of a presidential run, quote, nonsense. Antonio, really? What do we make of the governor suddenly pulling his head back into his shell when he's asked about 2024?
Well, same thing we made of former President Trump not mentioning DeSantis during that Sarasota rally a couple of months ago, namely, look, the governor swatting away the presidential talk is predictable and also unconvincing. You don't go traveling across the country to primary important states unless you have your eye on a larger prize. And he has been raising tons of money and getting tons of airtime. And it's worked out for him as he now has top-notch name recognition. Most people who launch a presidential campaign have the same immediate challenge, name recognition, getting people to know who you are. That's something DeSantis really no longer has to worry about. What he does have to worry about is Trump's ire, or at least his annoyance. It's interesting that the 2024 talk has been swirling since that Orlando CPAC straw poll back in February. But the governor did nothing to dissuade it until the same day that the anti-Trumper Lincoln Project released an ad taunting Trump because DeSantis was outshining him. And as for Trump, well, we told you so. We said it in a podcast back in February before he spoke at CPAC. The more he plays coy about his 2024 plans, the more it creates space for DeSantis and others to test the water and float their trial balloons. The problem, of course, is DeSantis isn't just any other potential rival, and his home state, Florida, isn't any other state. DeSantis is a Trump creation. He was a little-known Northeast Florida congressman, albeit a Fox News star, but when a particular tweet from @RealDonaldTrump basically catapulted him to the governor's mansions in 2018. In Trump world, that means you're beholden to Trump. And Florida is Trump's home base. And as we have said, the Trumpiest state in the country. So you don't want to cross the former president here. Having said all that, look, none of this is that deep-seated right now. The governor has a re-election campaign next year. And it's really in his best interest to cool the 2024 talk anyways. You know, it never looks good to be running for a state office when you're telegraphing that you've got some of that Potomac fever in you.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, Mark, the governor's poll numbers have taken a hit now lately as well. And I'm wondering, do you think, you know, at least for optics sake, he's trying to make it sound like he's keeping his eyes on the prize closest to him, which is running for re-election?
Well, you know, DeSantis, to me, has proven to have keen political instincts. And I'm sure that there are voters out there who are judging him based on his performance through this Delta variant pandemic, or the pandemic of the unvaccinated. You know, he's surely aware that there is no 2024 without winning in 2022. So, yeah, I guess it is a time for him to downplay the, you know, running for president stuff, even as he continues to carry a national profile and travel to places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Utah, raking in, you know, big time dollars for his political committee from Fox News viewers out there who see him as the next big thing for the GOP.
Well, while he's not running for president, evidently, DeSantis has been traveling the state lately, touting the benefits of monoclonal antibodies for treating COVID patients and those at high risk of the virus. The state's COVID numbers and hospitalizations have been at a record level, and the governor continues to fight masks in school, even though he did suffer a setback this week before a Leon County Circuit judge who already ruled throughout the mask mandate ban that he has enacted, the governor has. But Antonio, the governor has been reveling in testimonials from COVID patients that have been helped by these antibody treatments. And I kind of wonder what the messaging is here. Is he kind of saying to the anti-vaccine community that he so often plays to, basically, you know, don't worry about getting vaccinated or taking COVID precautions, but if you do get sick, hey, we'll keep you from having a really bad outcome.
Yeah, let me tell you something. The people I've been talking to point out that this is magnetically appealing for Republicans and maddeningly, you know, frustrating to Democrats. Look, here's been the governor's argument more or less. You can get the vaccine or not, and you can wear a face covering if you want to. And if you get sick, yeah, you can go to the hospital. But before you do that, first stop at my Regeneron Center and get your monoclonal antibody cocktail, and maybe that just takes care of it. You know, there's a lot of moving parts in that argument, especially when you compare it to what President Biden and the Democrats are saying, which is basically, just get the vaccine and get it now. You can't get any more clear cut than that. Yet, interestingly, a Gallup poll released Wednesday said that just 40% of Americans believe Biden has communicated a quote unquote clear plan of action with regard to COVID. And Florida just seems A-OK with DeSantis and this kind of convoluted plan. So what gives? I mean, I've been kind of perplexed by this as well. So I've talked to people, and one thing I keep hearing is, look, Florida is a small and medium-sized business economy. We do not have a Fortune 500 corporate base here. And nothing scares Florida business owners and workers more than the words lock and down. And the experience of last year's shutdown was traumatic for a lot of people. Yeah, losing your life to COVID is worse than losing your job or your livelihood. But many Floridians are convinced that COVID is fatal to just a small percentage of people. And they have decided, for better or worse, that they're just going to roll the dice on it. And the way people see it, DeSantis is leaving the choice to them. And maybe that's been the more appealing and ultimately the simplest message of all.
Yeah, and it's true because indeed DeSantis often plays that choice being we can go the way we are right now or lockdown. And, you know, even though I don't think anybody is advocating for lockdowns, but, you know, he seems to see no middle ground between his hands-off approach and then lockdown. Well, it's a crazy time, and we're heading for autumn, and of course we're well into the school year with cases skyrocketing around the state and quarantines and classrooms, but we're far from getting out of this COVID-19 peril right now. But hey, wait a minute, here comes that number picking music again. Are we ready for the reveal? Antonio, you came in here with a 2,456. Can you tell us what that was about?
I did, John. Look, this week we marked the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attack and the ensuing war in Afghanistan, and that conflict claimed the lives of 2,456 U.S. military personnel. And I'm going to talk about two of those casualties in particular, ones I kind of have a connection with. The first was Private First Class Juan Sebastian Restrepo, who was a U.S. Army medic from Pembroke Pines, and he was killed early in his deployment in 2007. Now, I did not know PFC Restrepo, but I am reminded of him every day because Restrepo attended the same high school that my nieces attended and the same high school that my kids graduated from. And on the road outside the school, which I nearly pass by every day, there's a historical marker with his name and a snippet of his story. The other casualty was Staff Sergeant Matthew Sitton of Largo. He was killed in August of 2012. I met Sitton's widow and 10-month-old son a few weeks later that year. And to this day, I remember the look of grief and shock on his widow's face. Now, I've been reflecting about the different lives of each of these men, as well as the other 2,454 Americans who died in Afghanistan, and how those lives would have been different, and the lives they would have lived, have been able to live, if not for the attacks in Manhattan, the Pentagon, and the field in Pennsylvania that sad and stunning morning. You know, God bless them and everyone who served in that conflict. And on Saturday morning, as we commemorate the anniversary of that attack, they also reflect on the sacrifices our military made in that longest of American wars that followed. Some 2,977 Americans died in the attacks of September 11, 2001. Going forward, I would argue that total should also reflect the U.S. military members who died in Operation Enduring Freedom. You know, may their memories endure and be a blessing to the loved ones they have left behind.
Yeah, that's well said, Antonio. I know it's a horrible remembrance this weekend, and you know, we have generations affected by that war. Mark, on a $40.4 million note, what was that?
$40.4 million is the amount of dollars Governor Ron DeSantis has raised for his PAC in 2021 alone. A hefty chunk of that is money from out of state, which speaks to his anointment as a leading presidential contender in 2024. I would also note that meanwhile, Democrats Charlie Crist and Nikki Fried haven't raised one tenth of that amount combined. That's not to say a Democrat can't win in 2022, but DeSantis has a stupendous advantage there.
Yeah, the money difference between the candidates is overwhelming. And I wrote a little bit last week about the tall tasks facing Democrats, and that is just one of many, because they're also facing a decline in voter registration and really just a upheaval, a track record of having lost in this state now since the last century. So it's a hard thing to turn around. My number was 48, and like Antonio, I was kind of reflecting a little bit on the 9/11 anniversary coming up. The 48 stands for $48 billion, which was the size of Florida's state budget on September 11th, 2001. That's less than half the Florida's current spending plan. But over the course of two decades, we can see a lot of the dynamics of what powers the state really hasn't changed that much. I'll explain that in a moment. But you know, like everyone who was around that day, I have memories of that chaotic time of September 11th. I was a reporter here in Florida's capital, and we quickly converged on Governor Jeb Bush, the brother of the then President George W. Bush, who was in the middle of what was a routine meeting in Tallahassee, but away from the Capitol building. Of course, there were immediate security concerns, and the Capitol was evacuated, and the governor didn't speak to reporters for very long, but he was whisked away and kept out of sight for the rest of the day. There were worries that somehow Tallahassee could be a target, you know, because of the governor's presence, but that didn't happen. Still, the shutdown of U.S. air travel for 2 days after the attack, followed by a massive downturn in travel and tourism, that really rippled through Florida's economy quickly. And we saw a similar financial slump just last year when COVID-19 halted tourism. Jeb Bush, within a few weeks of 9/11, he was traveling to cities around the country as kind of a roving Florida tourism ambassador, trying to get people to come back to the state, you know, travelers, visitors. But people were wary, and the numbers just kept cratering. And within just a few weeks of 9/11, the legislature was back in a special session, and they cut $1 billion from that $48 billion budget, which, you know, much of the reduction was coming in education and healthcare. The Republican-controlled legislature even delayed a tax cut for investors, postponing a scheduled reduction to the state's intangibles tax, which Bush and other Republicans had seized on as an unfair tax on seniors and savers. It did eventually go away, but not in the, you know, in the immediate wake of 9/11. But, you know, that day and that event taught us many things. We soon got heightened security at the Capitol, metal detectors and security bollards on the ground that, you know, never were there before. But, you know, the swiftness with which the state's finances can be turned upside down, that was evident. And it had not really been seen in recent memory at that time. But since 9/11, we've gone through similar downward roller coaster rides with the housing collapse of 2007 and 2008, and then just last year, COVID-19. So, you know, this Florida economy is still pretty fickle, and things can happen. Thankfully, 9/11 is a little bit in our distant memory, but it'll be close to the minds of many of us this weekend. Well, that's all the time we have for this week on Inside Florida Politics. I'd like to thank our producer extraordinaire, Thomas Gordy, who put this show together for us. And thank you all for listening. And remember, stay cool, Florida.